Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, let me thank all of you for being here and thank Michael for being here.
I haven't been here since you're all in these palatial new, this palatial new headquarters. It's like the Taj Mahal.
Right. I want to go through our Commonwealth Club opening because the recordings that they use here always likes the traditional gavel. So here we go. That means we're on.
As long as you don't use it against the guest, that's fine.
No.
Not yet, anyway.
I got tennis elbow doing it. So
I'm relieved to hear, I guess.
I don't think Michael needs any introduction, right? We are very lucky, I think, in our present days to have historians who have a perspective on history. And I differentiate between historians and journalists. We also have journalists who have a perspective on history, but they are trying to write the first draft of history. Michael is writing the draft of history that we can go back and reread and help us understand current events through our own thought process rather than somebody else telling us what we should think. And his book that we're going to talk about today, Presidents of War, is a very good example of that because he goes through technically 9 different presidencies and talks about the events that surrounded those presidencies in the context of war. And when you read it, which I really encourage all of you to do, you will find incredible, valuable material to help give us insight into the circumstances that we're living in, experiencing today. So we're going to talk about the book as a historical record of presidents of war. And I normally, when somebody asks an author about the title, that means they haven't read the book and they're looking for a way to.
Yes, but what was your idea about the picture on that jacket?
Yeah, exactly. And who took the photo on the back?
Right. The price is so interesting.
But in this case, the use of the preposition, presidents of war, is very revealing about the theme and the purpose of your book. So I'm going to pretend like I've read the book and ask.
Yeah, well, okay, yes. You know him well enough to know that he probably knows the book at this point better than I do. He's read it so closely. But the book is about presidents who not only run big wars in American history, 8 or 9 of them, but also how they come to wage war. How they demand of the Congress and the American people that we get into a big conflict. And the larger reason for the title is that there's an experience that is shared by these, actually 8 presidents that I really write about, that is unique in American history because the most sacred thing a president does is send young Americans off to die. And that's an experience that not even any other president has, at least in that large number. So it's sort of, what is it? What do they have in common? And just humanly, in terms of biography, what's the experience like? And I found that an amazing number of them had emotional breakdowns. A higher number than you'd expect had physical breakdowns, sometimes fatal ones. Almost every single one of them got more religious. Lady Bird Johnson, whom I got to know pretty well in her last years, said that when the Vietnam War was the hardest, she wouldn't have been surprised if Lyndon had become a Catholic. And really serious.
Yeah.
And the reason was that their daughter Lucy had converted to Catholicism. She was born an Episcopalian, converted when she was 16 years old, and she took her father to a church in Southwest Washington, which was run by what she called my little monks. And LBJ, during the height of the Vietnam War, would talk to the monks, and it gave them huge comfort, and so Lady Bird was serious. Abraham Lincoln was almost an atheist when he was younger, and when he was president fighting the Civil War, waging the Civil War, he was visited by a friend of his youth who found him reading the Bible and said, you know, is this really you reading the Bible? I can't believe it. And Lincoln said, I can't understand how anyone could go through this experience of sending so many people off to die without becoming more religious. One thing that Lincoln said to another old friend, he said, can you believe that I, who can barely watch a chicken being slaughtered, I am now making decisions that are responsible for oceans of blood, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young Americans being killed. So the point of the title is that there are only about 8 or 9 people in American history who've had that horrible experience, mm-hmm. and it's about how they deal with it, what it is like from the inside, what their relationship is with their wives. You know, no female president yet. It's long overdue. Mm-hmm. But it's basically trying to capture that experience over 200 years.
And it's an interesting lesson in constitutional history. I mean, before we get into the actual substance of the presidencies, I think a bit of a review of where the war power, the power to declare war as opposed to make war, resides under the Constitution.
Right. Yeah, I was last night at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. Anyone been there? It's right near where the Constitution was written. And they have these statues of the founders that look quite realistic, so it's a little bit intimidating. I tried to use less bad language than I usually did, at least when I was in the room with those statues.
Yeah.
But anyway, their idea when they were writing the Constitution was, as most of you know, they wanted to make sure that this new office, the President of the United States, would not become some kind of king or dictator. And what they were worried most of all was that a president would be like a British king. And British kings, sometimes when they got unpopular, they would look for a reason to go to war, because if you went to war, suddenly all the people have a sense of mission and they unite, and they unite behind their beloved leader, the king. And so the founders of this country wanted to make sure that that did not happen here, that you had presidents who were tempted to go to war for political reasons. Therefore, they wanted to make sure that the choice of going to war was the choice not of a president, but of Congress. That's why the Constitution mm-hmm. says, if you're a president and you want a war, you've got to go to Congress and ask for a war declaration.
Right.
Anyone know the last time a president asked Congress for a war declaration?
Yeah.
What year? 1942, exactly.
Yeah.
And second question, have we had any wars since 1942? So something right. is going off the rails here, right. and one of the reasons why presidents can get us into war, I would say single-handedly and sometimes overnight, and maybe for crass political reasons to win an election, if they want to, is exactly that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an important point as we go through this, because the Constitution is riddled with ambiguities, and this is an interesting example, because the Congress has the power, the sole power, to declare war, but the president is the commander-in-chief. So where does the power to declare the war and the
exactly
power to
the problem
the war, right?
And one other problem is that, you know, as I write in this book, presidents have much too often got us into big wars for fake reasons, which is just what the founders worried about. You know, James Polk, as I write about, fabricated a fake border incident on the Texas-Mexico border and then went to Congress and said, the Mexicans have attacked us. We need a major war where we go and occupy Mexico City, which is about a two-year war, which he did. William McKinley, none of us were around then, but in 1898, there was a ship called the Maine, Havana Harbor. It was sunk. McKinley went to Congress and said, we've got to go to war against the Spanish in revenge for this horrible attack on an American ship. Little problem is that the ship was sunk not by Spain, but by a boiler accident. Yeah. And McKinley could not go to Congress and say, I want you to declare war against all boilers around the world.
Yeah.
And then LBJ with the Gulf of Tonkin. So this is a problem the founders would have been very worried about.
Right, and that's when now we've gotten into continuing resolutions and authorizations.
Yeah, which are nothing.
But let's go back to the guy who wrote it, Madison, because he gets a lot of chops for having done a good job writing the Constitution.
So far, so good.
So far, so good, right? And then he's a Secretary of State under Jefferson. And then president. So tell us about Madison.
It was not a great career move for him to become president. The problem is that Madison, of all people, at the Constitution Convention, he was one of those who were at the forefront saying, make sure that presidents not only don't get us into unnecessary wars, but don't get us into wars that are not supported by a vast majority of the American people. Mm-hmm. And by unnecessary, he meant, you know, not essential for our national security. Right. So once he's president, it's 1812, and he's running for re-election. And he wants to be popular, and also he's nervous about the fact that the British have been harassing our ships. And also, there's some members of Congress who think it'd be a great idea to have a war to steal Canada, right. Make Canada part
that
of the United
States. That was
British
at that time.
Yeah, which was British and French.
Yeah.
So British Canada would be taken over by the U.S. So he goes to Congress and asks for this war, and the two war aims are, it's not the language he used, steal Canada and stop the Brits from bothering our ships.
Yeah.
Now, the Brits, about 2 weeks later, sent word that they would stop bothering our ships, so that part of the war aims was gone. And the other war aim was steal Canada. And would the founders have thought stealing Canada was essential to our national defense? I don't think so. And that's why this is so sad for Madison's memory, because he was a hypocrite, basically. He was someone who, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, was saying wars should only be fought for sacred, supreme reasons. And of all people, he's the president who opens the door to presidents getting us involved in unnecessary wars for fake reasons, which has happened too often in American history, all the way up to the Gulf of Tonkin.
And in the movie Stripes, this is an aside, but in the movie Stripes, Bill Murray tells about he wants to join the Army, and his friend says, why? And he says, because they're 10-1. And he was referring to the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. But you have an interesting trivia point about the War of 1812.
Well, here, I'll ask it as a question. Do all mine audience interaction? Or no one is required. There are no marshals here at the... what was the most unpopular war in American history? It was not Vietnam. It was the War of 1812. What was the first war we lost? Not Vietnam, it was the War of 1812, because remember those war aims, stealing Canada and stopping the British harassment? We ended the war without achieving either of those goals, but Madison was so good at spinning the result of that war that you didn't focus on the fact that we didn't achieve anything that we had been asking for. You focused instead on the Star-Spangled Banner. Would you mind handing me the book for a second, Roy?
Yeah.
This is not to hawk the book. This is to show you something else.
Yeah.
Even I'm doing this front of the book, Star-Spangled Banner, you know, with the rocket, rockets. You know, it's poetic. You can't think that was part of a war that we lost. Don't give up the ship, Old Ironsides, Andrew Jackson at New Orleans, all these things that sort of wove the legend of the great victory, which didn't exist, of the War of 1812. And the real problem with that is that encouraged later presidents to seek the glory of war as well. And one of them was James Polk, whom I've already mentioned, who had a cane. And the cane was emblazoned with victorious scenes of the War of 1812. So he thought it might be nice to be a president of war, too.
Polk doesn't have a lot of biographies written about him.
Yeah, no biographer wants to punish himself by writing. I mean, he was a liar and a cheat and a bully, and maybe liars and cheats and bullies like to write about those.
Right.
But
the one favor he did was he promised to be a one-term president, and he kept it.
He did, and also it's a perfect case of ends versus means, which is true of every human being we all deal with, you know. Everyone we know sometimes does things that have worthy ends, but we wish that their means were a little bit less corner-cutting. And that's true of presidents, and Polk is a great example, because if it were not for Polk, we'd be sitting in Mexico at the moment.
Yeah.
It was he who acquired almost 1 million square miles of American territory, what was called Upper California in those days, as opposed to Lower California, mm-hmm. and New Mexico and some other pieces of land. So am I glad that Polk made us a continental nation coast to coast? Right. Sure I am, and I think everyone here is more or less. But as I say, you know, he lied. Mm-hmm. He told Congress he wanted this war only for the reasons of, you know, restoring justice mm-hmm. with Mexico, when in fact his ulterior motive was always to get that land.
Right.
And again, the problem is that we sometimes, is it all right if I move into current events for 45 seconds?
Mm-hmm.
These days we hear the term democratic norms, which is not a term I think I even used before 18 right. months ago. And so Madison and especially Polk were establishing a democratic norm, which was, it's okay for a president to get us involved in a major war, killing a lot of Americans for fake reasons he does not tell you. And that was a very bad example yeah. for later presidents.
And that's, if you trace the line back, that's where it started.
Yeah.
So let's go to a good guy. Let's go to Lincoln. And I'm in, you know, we
and
could
an spend, island of stability in a troubled region.
Yes, we could spend several hours talking just about Lincoln and his conduct of the war. I think the part that Lincoln demonstrates that I'd like to focus on is his planning for exiting of the war. His second inaugural was just a brilliant document.
With malice toward right. none, charity for all.
And the war came.
Yes.
Right.
And it shows two things about Lincoln. Number one, the great war presidents are those who wage war on a moral plane.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln tried for his first year and a half to basically say, claim I have no dog in the fight, you know, it's not slavery that's the issue, right. I'm just fulfilling my oath by reuniting the country as the Constitution requires. After a while, he got tired of saying that because he knew it didn't really express what was yeah. in his heart. So the second he began talking about this as a struggle against the evil of slavery, it actually turned out to be good military strategy because it led people who were fighting on his side to feel that they were fighting for a cause, not just for the legalistic reunion of, you know, two sides where Southern states had seceded. And the other thing is that if I had to have a quality in a president, at the top would be morality and integrity,
mm-hmm.
but pretty close to that would be the ability to explain to people, citizens of the United States, why something that you, the president, was doing, even though they disagreed with it, why was the right thing.
Right. And empathy, we'd add to that.
Empathy, yeah, if we're going to go through the list. I mean, empathy. Lincoln, for example, it's one of the reasons I love him. And as the war ground on, there were so many Americans who were dying because of his decisions, and his people came to him and said, Mr. Lincoln, we have to have a new national cemetery. Where do you want it? And Lincoln said, I want it built near my summer home. He had this summer cottage up the hill from the White House, because every time I take my horse and carriage to the cottage, I want to see the fresh graves being dug of young men who have died because of decisions I've made. Said, this is going to be so painful for me, but I never want to be disconnected from those decisions or see them as too abstract. I want to feel the pain that their families feel mm-hmm. so that I understand what it is that I am doing. How many other presidents would have said that?
Yeah. We've discussed McKinley, so let's leave the Spanish-American War alone and go to Woodrow Wilson.
I'm going to be even meaner about Wilson. Is that okay?
That comes through in the book.
Yeah, I'm pretty rough on Wilson as a war president, which I'll tell you about in a second. But I always give my chapters to experts in the areas that I'm writing about. So I gave my Wilson chapters to not only a noted Wilson scholar who will remain nameless, but also someone who really admires Wilson. Because I wanted, you know, if I'd gone too far, I wanted him to tell me. And the best, he wrote comments on the margin, and the best one he wrote was, would you at least consider taking out the words messianic and conceited? So you see which way this is going.
Yeah.
So the reason I'm mean on Wilson is a couple of things. Number one, and it is related to war, is race. This was a horrible, vicious racist who sometimes excused this as, you know, Wilson was a man of his time. He wasn't a man of his time. Theodore Roosevelt had served
and
before
Taft.
Him was much, and Taft were much more advanced on race, and so was Warren Harding, his successor. Uh-huh. This was someone who was so vicious a racist that he threw African Americans out of the government. He screened Birth of the Nation, that film that was a peon to the Ku Klux Klan. This is a guy who, despite his pretensions, had a very bad soul in many important respects. But more than that, does anyone remember, not from life experience, but from studying, what Wilson's motto, what his slogan was in running for re-election in 1916? What was it?
He kept us out of war.
Well, A, it was a lie because he had already been at war in Mexico briefly, so that wasn't true. And B, wouldn't you think that a candidate who runs under that slogan is basically implying that if you elect me again, I'll continue to keep you out of war? I mean, that's what he was doing, and he knew it was a lie because he was likely to get the United States into World War I. He knew very quickly after his re-election if it happened. He won re-election by a very narrow margin, and guess who was responsible for that margin? California, and even more specifically, women voters. Now, women could vote in some states in 1916. It was not guaranteed, mm-hmm. but there were women voters. And guess what one issue drove them to vote for Woodrow Wilson? They wanted to keep us out of war. So he was elected to another term under totally false pretenses by largely women who emotionally felt so strongly that they didn't want to see their sons die and they didn't want to see a wasteful war, and he knew it. So I don't know how many of you have read Woodrow Wilson's books in political science, but they do not exactly praise presidents who lie and cheat and tell you false things to get elected. So there's a little hypocrisy there that I don't find too attractive in Wilson either. Going beyond that, he gets us involved in the war in the spring of 1917. You can argue that round or flat. I think, you know, there are good reasons for that. But so many things are you missing with Wilson, such as advanced racial views and failure to lie when you're running for a second term. At least what I would expect from Wilson, of all people, is that, Roy, you got a Western Union.
I was so transfixed.
You see, I'm really, as a historian, advanced. No carrier pigeon.
It was Pony Express.
I've got two sons who are amazed that I can remember the year 1961, which they think is very funny. Anyway, so Wilson, the one thing you'd want from them is during his, you know, he gets you involved in the war, you know, first war on the other side of the ocean. Not exactly an immediate argument that, you know, the Germans are on our shores.
Right.
What does he do for the first year of America's entry in the war? He basically holes up in the White House and barely speaks. Mm-hmm. So the result is you don't even have the threshold requirement of a war president, which is that, especially in a war whose reasons are complex, he's not explaining to you why your kids are dying. He was at this kingly remove. He was above doing something like this. And then the war is won almost exactly 100 years ago. Centennial is in about 2 weeks. And then, everyone know the term mission creep? The most colossal early example of mission creep that I can think of. Surprise, says Wilson, you may not have known it, but this was a war to end all wars, a war to make the world safe for democracy, and one which is intended to culminate with a League of Nations that'll make sure war never happens again. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, argue about whether those three things were the right thing to do or not, but didn't he owe it to the public to at least tell them before the war was won?
And the Congress.
Yeah, and the Congress. And then finally, I mean, I'm all for the League of Nations. I wish he had succeeded, just in terms of competence. He then goes to Europe for about 6 months to negotiate the Paris Treaty because he was so messianic and conceited that he thought that he was the only one who could do that. This is an early example of I alone can fix it. A little full of himself, Wilson was. So he goes to Europe the first time a president is away from his job, out of the country for that long. And so guess who he is leaving the platform to discuss the League of Nations in his absence? Henry Cabot Lodge and other people who hated the idea. Yeah. So by the time Wilson gets back, the struggle for the League of Nations was almost lost, and it was soon lost in Congress. And the result is that with no League of Nations, you can argue that it led to the rise of Hitler and the advent of World War II. All those are things that I at least partially blame on Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, because it created a vacuum,
right,
basically.
So if there are any members of the Wilson Anti-Defamation League here, I apologize, or any descendants.
So we do lead to World War II, but in between it, we have a depression first, and we elect Franklin Delano Roosevelt as president.
Right, and Roosevelt, who knew that we probably would have to stop Hitler by going to war. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem he had, am I allowed to dump on Wilson once more?
Yeah.
Was people remembered World War I, which they found a big disappointment. By the mid-1930s, a lot of people were saying, and this was highly exaggerated, but Wilson got us involved in World War I to help the arms manufacturers and the chemical makers, the DuPonts and J.P. Morgan. A lot of people thought that, and all that made it 10 times harder for FDR to rearm this country to defend ourselves against Adolf Hitler. It made it so hard for him that he almost did not succeed, and we almost lost.
Mm-hmm. But Roosevelt was first managing a depression, and then he was managing an economic conflict with Japan.
Right.
And meanwhile, he was sitting in Washington watching Europe fall, England go through the Battle of Britain.
And a Senate particularly that was so isolationist, they were tying his hands.
And so there's been a lot of ink spent on Roosevelt's either unwitting or purposeful manipulation of events in order
to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Well, and that's another cost of, you remember I was talking about Polk with the fake border incident and McKinley with the fake Spanish attack against the Maine. Here's the problem, that when you have a real crisis, people begin to get suspicious and say, is this another fake crisis that the president has generated to get us into a war, to stampede Americans to support a struggle they otherwise would not support.
Right.
So a lot of people to this day, if either of us ever went on the radio tonight and the host said, you know, Roy and Michael are on to discuss Pearl Harbor and Franklin Roosevelt, guess what the first question is going to be. Yeah. Did Roosevelt put all those ships in Pearl Harbor to deliberately encourage the Japanese to attack so that he could scheme to get the United States involved in World War II? Mm-hmm. And the real answer from my point of view is that mainly he was innocent, but not entirely innocent. And he did not do that hoping that the ships would be bombed and people would be killed. It wasn't that. He made a very big mistake. And that was that until about a year before Pearl Harbor, that fleet was not in Pearl Harbor. It was in San Diego. And Roosevelt moved the boats from San Diego to Pearl Harbor. He did it because he thought that there would be a deterrent to a Japanese attack to have them out there in the middle of the Pacific. Very stupid mistake. It obviously was not a deterrent. And had they stayed at San Diego, it would have been much harder for these Japanese airplanes to bomb them. So he was responsible for the fact that he put those boats in a place that they could be attacked. And as I write in the book, what happened was that when Pearl Harbor happened, Roosevelt knew it, and he knew he had a big problem because he's starting World War II, America's entry in it, and he may be vilified for making this mistake that led to the Pearl Harbor attack.
Yeah.
And so he was a politician, and the positive interpretation is it was important for him not to be a commander-in-chief who was under question. So he went to a justice of the Supreme Court named Roberts and said, why don't you write a report on Pearl Harbor, and why don't you do it in about 5 weeks? And he intended it to be a whitewash.
Right.
And what happened was the report, and he met with Roberts a number of times while Roberts was writing this report, and the report basically cleared FDR and Marshall, and it put all the blame on the local commanders, Kimmel and Short, who had made stupid mistakes, but what Roosevelt was trying to do was make sure that he didn't have to be a wartime commander-in-chief operating under the incubus of people saying, one reason we're in this war is because you screwed up in putting those boats in Pearl Harbor, which he did.
But there was an interesting, going back to the congressional power to declare war, it might have been very difficult if Roosevelt had gone on his own initiative to get a declaration of war against Germany, right?
Without an attack on Pearl Harbor.
Without the, so Lincoln.
And he was lucky also that Hitler declared war on us once
That's the point. Yeah.
So, but that also leads to the suspicion. Mm-hmm. So basically, with all that having been said, I think Roosevelt was a great president for a lot of reasons, with the monumental exceptions, which are so monumental I shouldn't even refer to them as exceptions. The internment of the Japanese was one of the great atrocities of American history, which I'm not sure how much time we have to talk about, but that was extremely important. Well, and the others, I think he could have done more to thwart the Holocaust. So two of the enormous blots on the history of human beings, Roosevelt had a lot to do with.
Yeah. The role of Eleanor was interesting in there.
Well, even, and this is something I had not known until I wrote about it, she privately was totally against the Japanese internment. And you know, because you've read the book. And she argues with Franklin, it's not necessary. Even J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI director, says that this is not necessary for national security. And he abruptly did it anyway. You know, that terrible executive order, February of 1942. And to her credit, it is said by those who knew her well that she was never as close to her husband ever again. That she basically felt that if this is the way that Franklin operates, you know, he shares my values much less than I thought he did.
Yeah.
It was already a troubled marriage, but by 1942, at least she had felt that I share his political purposes, even though I may not share his intimate life. And from that point on, she was more absent from the White House. I mean, it was a much cooler marriage, and one big reason was his abrupt decision on the Japanese internment. And she kept on saying, I want to go to the camps. You know, I hear the conditions are terrible. And he kept on saying no. Finally, she got to go to a camp which was called Gila River in Arizona, which was said to be basically sort of the Hollywood version of the camps, probably where the treatment was the nicest. So that was the one that they let her go to. But she saw through it. And so, for instance, she asked, with photographers present, to have a glass of milk, which they gave her, milk that was given to the people who were interned there. And she loudly said, it's sour.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she made it clear that this was not this wonderful place where everyone was being treated beautifully, you know, separately but equal.
Yeah, she's a fascinating part of Roosevelt's gestalt. Roosevelt, of course, passes away before Germany surrenders. So Harry Truman takes over.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And he decides to drop the atomic bomb. He gets a lot of criticism for that and a lot of defense. Where do you come down on that?
I would be on the defense side. Had he not done that, he would have been impeached. And there would have been a continued war that would killed would have killed huge numbers.
Yeah, Okinawa seemed to demonstrate that.
Yeah, I mean, none of this is, I mean, even just the firebombing of Tokyo in the spring of 1945, I think there was something like 400,000 killed.
Yeah.
And again, I know this is not a clear-cut argument, and you know, this was not a good thing that he did. It was a choice between, you know, horrible possibilities.
But I'm laying, I'm putting a marker down here because
to go on to Korea.
Yeah,
right. I want to go. Which I mainly read about here.
So he becomes his own president of war.
Yeah, and a war that he really waged on his own Korea in 1950, which I'm not mean against Truman up to the Wilson level, but I think that the Truman that we remember, and he's one of my heroes, and still is.
Well, he, for example, integrated the armed services.
Yes, absolutely. He did many wonderful things. Yeah. And fired MacArthur later on. Mm-hmm. It was said that when MacArthur went back and spoke to Congress, Democrats were worried he'd run against Truman, so MacArthur gives this emotional speech, and it was said on the Republican side of the House of Representatives, as MacArthur spoke, there was not a dry eye. And on the Democratic side, there was not a dry seat because they were all worried that he would run against Truman. So he made decisions like that.
Yeah.
But the point is that in Korea, he says after the North Koreans invade the South, let's go to defend South Korea. I'm fine with him so far. Mm-hmm. His aide said, okay, let's go to Congress and get a war declaration. And guess what Truman said? Mr. Plain speaking, Mr. Defender of the Constitution, he says, I don't want to do that because we're going to have an acrimonious debate. 5 months from now, I've got midterm elections. Right. So Truman said, you know, I just won't I won't ask Congress. I don't have to, and I'm sure they won't mind.
Mm-hmm. Citing James Polk, saying,
I love Polk, of all people. So he waged this war against the North Koreans for 3 years with no declaration of war from Congress. And you may think that I'm just being legalistic and, you know, what is a little war declaration between friends or absence of one?
Right.
Problem is, you do something like that, it encourages later presidents to do bad things. When Franklin Roosevelt interned the Japanese and cut some other corners, decades later, Richard Nixon is waging the Vietnam War, and he says, well, Roosevelt was a war president. Right. I'm a war president, so I can do some bad things, too. So in Truman's case, he licensed President Johnson, 1964, 14 years later. There's this fake incident in the Gulf of Tonkin where Johnson claims there was an unprovoked attack against an American ship and bombs North Vietnam and gets a resolution from Congress almost unanimous saying use of armed force against Vietnam, which Johnson and Nixon for a whole decade used that resolution to wage a war that killed 60,000 Americans. Fake incident, no declaration of war. People said, why didn't you ask Congress for a declaration? And Johnson says, Truman didn't, I don't have to either.
And what happened 2 weeks after the Tonkin Resolution was passed?
Well, one thing that happened
this
was
This is my
that,
trivia question.
Yeah, well, I hope I'm answering the question out of my own book rightly, that this is what Roy is going for.
Yeah.
He finds out that there was no attack after
Exactly,
all.
Yeah.
And so, and I love Johnson on civil rights and Medicare, a lot of other things. But I would hope that if a president found out that he had asked Congress for a resolution and gotten it, Gulf of Tonkin Resolution it was called, and a couple of weeks later privately finds out there was no attack, he would honestly go to Congress and say this was in good faith, but it didn't happen. And Johnson didn't, and he lied about it, and he kept on talking about this attack as if it had happened, and he knew it wasn't unprovoked, even if there was one, because we were provoking the North Vietnamese at that time. And so finally, William Fulbright, who was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, finds out about a lot of this. And another scoop I've got in the book is that Fulbright is talking with his colleagues on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, including Democrats. In those halcyon bygone days, a president would be criticized by leaders of his own party in Congress. Don't think that happens anymore, and we had a better system when it did happen.
Yeah.
So anyway, Fulbright in private, and these documents were locked up for decades, and I was able to find it, Fulbright is saying, we've been lied to by President Johnson, and this is taking a part of our democracy away for a president to lie so flagrantly over something so momentous as a war. And he and his colleagues say to each other, we think maybe he needs to be impeached. And if LBJ had not pulled himself out of the race in March of 1968, 2 months later, we might have seen an impeachment of LBJ in 1968.
Yeah.
One very positive step that Johnson took involved Westmoreland's recommendation.
Yeah, totally. And I'm glad to say something nicer about Johnson, which is new, which is... In fact,
you made the New York Times.
Yeah, Sunday New York Times was on the front page. I mean, whoever thought, you know, a history of book about dead guys would make it right under the fold.
Right into the failing New York Times.
Right, yeah. I'm showing my age by saying under the fold. My children would have no idea what that means.
Right.
It's like explaining typewriters and telephone booths and...
And you dial a number.
Right, yeah, exactly right. What happened was, turns out, in January of 1968, few of you remember William Westmoreland. Fine person, but not the sharpest knife in the drawer, it turns out. And Westmoreland is contacting LBJ and says, you know, I've got the way to end the Vietnam War and thwart a defeat at Khe Sanh. Tactical nuclear weapons. And Johnson says, hell no, that's the last thing I want. You know, I don't want them to be used in Vietnam and can spread. Could bring in, this is the LBJ Anti-Defamation League calling. And no telephone booth, so we're doing it on iPhone.
Yeah.
But in any case, what Johnson, to his eternal credit, said was, I don't want to provoke the Russians to come in. I don't want to provoke the Chinese by using nuclear weapons against the North Vietnamese or dropping them down, you know, some smokestack in Hanoi, because this could very quickly become a nuclear war that could kill 60 million people. And look at it historically. What if that had happened? Let's say that 30 million people had been killed. Would the defense, you know, would even winning the Vietnam War, the Civil War in this agricultural company country, be worth that? I mean, Johnson did the right thing. And he also said, I want every piece of paper connected with this request by Westmoreland to be locked up in a safe, and I don't want anyone to talk about this because I don't want any pressure from, you know, reporters at home or generals saying that LBJ is preventing us from winning when all we have to do is use a nuke.
Yeah.
And so these were locked up for decades, and some of these documents didn't come out until 2 years ago, and so that's why I was able to find this as a scoop. But it's a very good deed that Johnson did in the course of Vietnam, and he didn't do many.
Well, let's go to one that was not on his plus side, and just editorializing to set the framework. That war was probably... We today, when we read polls, we see so much loss of faith in institutions, right? That even now the Supreme Court is down in the 30s, the Congress is...
And I think, sadly, deserves to be.
Yeah.
That's a whole other subject.
Yeah. I attribute a lot of that to... It, not to the Korean War or not to the period of Eisenhower's U-2 incidents and so forth, but of the public awareness of the lying around Vietnam. And you talk in the book about a conversation that occurred very early, I believe it was 64, between McNamara and Johnson, when Johnson is exploring his conundrum.
Well, the worst of all is, I think, the worst thing a president can do is send young Americans to die under false pretenses. I think Polk was bad. Mm-hmm. I think McKinley was bad. I think Johnson should not have done this. But even worse than that, that's my second circle of hell. The inner circle of hell is what I'm about to say. And that is when a president tells young Americans, I'm sending you into a noble struggle that I expect to win, when in private, from the very beginning, he thinks it can never be won. And I love LBJ in many respects, but he did that, and that was a very bad thing. And the moment that really shows that is February of 1965. He's talking to Robert McNamara, his defense secretary, whom I see as another villain of this period for reasons that I'd be glad to explain, at least briefly. But he says to McNamara, and this is just at the moment Johnson is sending large numbers of young Americans to Vietnam, off to die, and telling them, we expect to win this war, it's a noble struggle. But in private, he's telling McNamara, I can't think of anything worse than losing the war in Vietnam, and I do not see any way that we can win. And I thought, well, you know, maybe Johnson was subject to depression, and maybe he was just having a moment in a funk. But you listen to more tapes, and in private, that's what he's saying. And Lady Bird, whom I got to know pretty well, she gave me some of her unpublished diaries. And in the summer of 1965, she records Lyndon telling her about the war in Vietnam. I feel as if I'm in a plane that's crashing, and I do not have a parachute. This is the first year of American involvement, and it's pornographic to me that a president of the United States could have sent young people off to die for a war that he knew that he was going to lose above and beyond anything else. And as much as I admire LBJ in other ways, that's about as bad as it gets. So since I'm writing about presidents of war, if you're asking me what's the worst thing a president of war can do, I can't think of anything worse than that.
And it wasn't as though the war just lasted a little bit longer.
This went on for 9 long years.
After
LBJ extended it for 4 more years. And as I write, I don't write mainly about Nixon, but Nixon comes into this. One of the worst presidential elections, in my view, in history was the election of 1968 for a lot of reasons. But let me just mention two. One is Nixon pretended that if you voted for him, he might be more dovish than Hubert Humphrey, LBJ's vice president, and he might end the war more quickly, when in fact...
Well, he actually said he had a secret plan.
Said he had a secret plan, which implies that you're going to get out. And in fact, he basically intended to and did extend the Lyndon Johnson policy of waging this war for 4 more years. And the other thing that was just as bad that I write about is that, and some of this has been known, LBJ, just before the election in 1968, wanted to declare a bombing halt on Halloween that would lead to peace talks. And he did that. It was 5 days before the election. Nixon knew that that would probably elect Hubert Humphrey as Johnson's vice president, because everyone wanted peace, and Johnson's bombing halt seemed to be pointing to peace pretty soon. So Nixon, through intermediaries, went to the South Vietnamese government and said, throw a monkey wrench into these peace talks. Why don't you refuse to come to the table so that they will collapse? Nixon will give you a better deal than Humphrey would. And so they did this, and the South Vietnamese refused to come to the table. And voters came flooding back to Nixon, and so Nixon wins the election 2 days later by 400,000 votes out of whatever it was, 60 million. As close an election really as 1960 or 2000. So LBJ knew what Nixon was doing because, and another theme of this book is how presidents abuse power during war. He abused the FBI, used the IRS. If you were a columnist who was writing against LBJ on the war, your taxes had better be in order because auditors would descend on you.
Right.
That's one way that Johnson compelled. And again, I'm trying to stay non-political, but we have a president who wants a lot of power, and one of the ways that presidents do this is, especially during wartime, but not only, they exploit being in a national security emergency to try to take on power that otherwise they might be denied. Did anyone happen to get a presidential alert announcement on your iPhones a couple of weeks ago? It's benign so far, but during wartime, presidents can now send you any messages directly that they feel like by exactly that device. And during war, presidents declare martial law, and they do all sorts of things, not only things like investigating your taxes or abusing the FBI. So all I'm saying is that if we are in a war in our generation, not just President Trump, you must be vigilant as a hawk to make sure that any president who involves us in a war does not abuse this power. Anyway, just to finish up on Nixon. Johnson knew what Nixon was doing because he had the Nixon circle wiretapped.
Of Anna Chennault.
Anna Chennault was one of the cutouts between the South Vietnamese and Nixon. So anyway, so Johnson calls up Nixon and says, Dick, I think this is treason, which actually it was. Mm-hmm. So you've got this lovely political situation where Nixon knows that Johnson can blackmail him, the new president, by revealing to Americans that he had committed treason. And Nixon thinks he's got blackmail material against LBJ because he can reveal that Johnson abused the FBI by tapping maybe his telephones, but including those around him. So welcome to the lovely world of politics 45 years ago.
Yeah, it hasn't gotten any better.
It's gotten worse.
Which is a perfect segue into the theme of many of the audience questions, and I'll try to summarize it in my own words. That when they wrote the Constitution, they had Article 1, Congress powers, Article 2, Executive, Article 3, the court.
I can talk about the court for a minute.
We will go there, but let's stay with 1 and 2 first. Very clear message that comes through in your book is that de facto the powers of the executive, the Article II, have been leapfrogged up, and now Congress is passive in its exercise of power.
And also, if a president goes to war, how many people in Congress are going to be thrilled to deny the poor soldiers on the field money to give them body armor?
So talk to us a bit about the expansion of presidential power.
War has been the quickest route to grabbing power for presidents through all this time, and that's the theme of the book.
Right.
Founders were worried presidents would become tyrants. Well, surprise.
Mm-hmm.
A president who's waging a war can do it, as I said, pretty much on his own. Congress is not likely to stand in his way. And an unscrupulous president who wants to use a time of war to seize power with martial law and some of the other things that I've talked about, use the FBI to intimidate any of us. That can happen in our time, and the founders failed because a president in our own time can become a tyrant by going to war. And this is not a Donald Trump comment. No. I began this book in 2007. I was just as worried then. I think it maybe is more likely now. But only because you have a president who is breaking so many democratic traditions and trying to increase his position of power. Mm-hmm. But in his case, for instance, 2011, President Trump, before he was president, tweeted a number of times, watch out because President Obama is going to start a war in order to get reelected. Mm-hmm. He says many times. Didn't happen, but it's not a great idea for any president to have in his mind the connection between going to war and getting reelected, or going to war and getting your polls up.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great idea, and it's something we just have to watch. The founders always wanted us to be vigilant about presidential power, so I am.
But that's why the Truman Act, police action, set the stage for so much.
And that's the problem. And may I say a word about the court?
Yes.
Another theme here is that presidents abuse what should be the distance between the court and the presidency. Harry Truman, I love him in so many ways, but not this one. He wanted to seize the steel mills, a really dictatorial act, even though there was a war in Korea. And even worse, he calls up the Chief Justice of the United States, as I describe it in the book, whom he had appointed. His poker buddy named Fred Vinson says, hey, Fred, do you mind? I'm thinking of seizing the steel mills. Yeah. If I did that, would the court think that's okay?
Right.
And Vinson, go ahead, Harry. We won't mind at all. Go ahead.
Right.
And then he seizes the steel mills, and to both of their surprise, the court overruled it and said no, thank God.
Yeah.
They had no business having a conversation like that. Lyndon Johnson appointed one of his closest friends, Abe Fortas, to the Supreme Court to basically be his spy on the court. and tell him what the justices were saying, what they were saying about his own legislation, you know, would it be overruled. He used Fortas to write speeches, to choose Vietnam bombing targets. I think you may see where I'm leading. Yeah. I'm worried about Brett Kavanaugh, not for partisan reasons. I'm a registered independent. This is not about politics. I'm terrified of too much presidential power. You have a conservative majority on the court, which is fine. Donald Trump won the election. He's entitled to appoint justices. Yeah. But Brett Kavanaugh may be indebted to Donald Trump in a way that we have not seen before.
And pre-committed.
Trump is pre-committed, but above and beyond that, Trump is very good at making people feel indebted. And during those 2 weeks when Kavanaugh's nomination was swaying in the wind, Trump could very well have pulled it and appointed someone else who did not have Kavanaugh's problems. And you can be absolutely certain he made it clear to Kavanaugh, whether he said it in these words or not, you owe me and you'd better remember it. Mm-hmm. Plus, for about 10 days, we know this is true, Kavanaugh was closeted at the White House with Trump's political people who were asking him, tell us all of your damaging secrets just so that we'll know those in case they come up in the hearings. Mm-hmm. So you've got Brett Kavanaugh going to the Supreme Court, knowing that Donald Trump has access to his damaging secrets. Is Donald Trump who would ever exploit something like that to get something he wanted? So we may, during this next year, our liberties may depend on a case that goes to the Supreme Court involving Donald Trump's excessive, in my view, seizure of power. And it goes to Brett Kavanaugh, who I think is much too in hock to Donald Trump for this post. Mm-hmm. And above and beyond that, Trump had a number of people on the Federalist Society list from whom he could have chosen. He'd committed himself to, you know, choose one of those, which is fine. That was his right. Guess which one he chose? He chose the one who has the most extremely permissive view of presidential power. 2009 article Kavanaugh wrote, presidents perhaps should not be subpoenaed, they should not be investigated, they should not be indicted, and they should use pardons in a really lavish way. It's a fringe, extreme view. So why do you think Donald Trump chose Kavanaugh, of all people, to go on the Supreme Court? Remember the case U.S. versus Nixon?
Yeah.
Nixon's tapes had been subpoenaed. With one of the greatest moments in American history, eight justices on a court, four of justices who have been appointed by Richard Nixon ruled unanimously against him. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure the same thing is going to happen a year from now if a case jeopardizing Donald Trump goes to the Supreme Court, and it makes me very nervous. Other than that, have a nice day.
what else can we say about the court? But that discussion goes to shaping the dialectic that develops throughout your book, because we start actually technically with the attack on the Chesapeake by British Navy in 1807.
Seems as recent to me, too.
That's the year you started the book, right?
Right, it seems like it.
Yeah. But the dialectic is built on the ability for the Article II, the executive power, to be expanded through the use of war. That's why.
Yeah, I mean, what it basically comes down to, and this is so much more topical than I expected it to be in 2007, if you are terrified of a president seizing too much power and having too little respect for the democratic norms that make most presidents feel a sense of restraint and modesty and unwillingness to use all the power available. If you're worried about that, you should be worried most of all that a president may get us into a war that is not necessary. That's the way it happens.
Right. And it goes beyond that, because war since the Vietnam War and even the Afghanistan 17-year war and Iraq has evolved, technical militarily, it's often asymmetric types of warfares. But we have now all kinds of new wars. We call them trade wars. We call
all these things, and even more than that, I mean, it hasn't happened, and I sure hope it never does. But we could have an unscrupulous president someday who will look at God forbid, something like 9/11,
mm-hmm.
and say, gee, Americans very quickly became united, and the president's poll ratings go up, and a president may ask Congress to go into a war that otherwise Americans never would have approved.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to carry out this scenario, and I'm not in any way predicting it, and I hope it never happens, but we've created a situation where if you have an unscrupulous president, that could one day happen, and we've got to watch out.
And but the coupling there is a abdicating Congress.
Which we've got. You've got a total lapdog Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that is not only, you know, to make this non-political, that is not only during the current administration.
Right.
Especially on matters of war and peace, there's this feeling that especially the leaders in the House and Senate of a president's own party are being patriotic by not criticizing him. You know, George W. Bush has written and said that he would have been a better war president had he gotten more criticism from Congress. He wouldn't have enjoyed it, right. But that's the way the system works. You know, yeah. We want the House and Senate to tell a president what he's doing wrong. You know, President Benjamin Franklin saying, our critic is our friend. You know, that should be a motto of the way that government operates. And too often in modern times, especially when young American men and women are in harm's way, members and leaders of Congress are very reluctant to criticize.
And it seems that that abdication has created a sense of divisiveness. If you look at our country right now, we have an economy that's overheated almost. We have lowest job unemployment numbers in a long time, the stock market's through the roof. If you were to look at it superficially based on numbers and metrics, we should be a happy country. I can't think of any time other than during the Vietnam War when I felt country is so polarized.
Well, as a historian, I don't know that anything that's happened to anyone with any president who's not dead, so I have no idea what's going
right.
on now.
But you're a journalist, Adam.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But if you're asking about current events, virtually every president has been aware of the fact that part of his job is to keep this nation together because there are all sorts of things that pull us apart, you know, national origin mm-hmm. and region, and we have different views and, you know, all sorts of things. You know, the glory of America is that we are so diverse, but the founders wanted a president who was a head of state who would always look for every opportunity to unite the country. Donald Trump is the first one I can think of who that's not in his software. And so I agree with you. Have we had times when we were more naturally divided? Absolutely. 1859 over slavery. We talked a little bit about 1940 when every American household seemed to be divided. Do we go to war against Adolf Hitler or not? But during the whole of 200 years of American history, we have usually had the emollient of a president always looking for ways to make it clear that we're all together and we're all united in at least some ways. And we've never before had a president whose MO is to do the opposite. So that is why it seems that way, in my opinion.
And we don't seem to read history.
That's another one. All right, it's Roy's fault. I was going to not get into the present, but one thing that unites all these war presidents is every single one of them in some way was a student of history. President Trump wears it as a badge of honor that he does not read books and he doesn't read history. Harry Truman said, I think rightly, he didn't understand how a president could function as president without knowing history. He said, not every reader in America will be a leader, but every leader must be a reader. And his whole point was that, you know, this is my language, not his, but how can you be president with all these decisions? You don't have enough information, and sometimes you're tired, you're mm-hmm. making 10 decisions at once. The only user's guide you've got is to know where previous presidents and previous American citizens succeeded and failed. And he said he couldn't have functioned without it. And he said the one book that affected him more than any other was one that his mother got from a traveling salesman. It had the horribly politically incorrect title of Great Men and Famous Women. the premise being that women could not be great, only famous. And the subtitle was From Nebuchadnezzar to Sarah Bernhardt. So you can see it covered a wide swath of human experience. But Truman's point was that when he had to fire MacArthur or make these other big decisions, and he made a lot of them, he would think of Abraham Lincoln or Andrew Jackson, and there was never an exact parallel, but they gave him a little bit of a sense of perspective that he felt that he wouldn't have if he did not know as much American history.
Yeah, and just maybe to finish on a fine point, but you talking about your discussion of Johnson and his conundrum about a war that he was continuing but knew he couldn't win. He had gotten counsel from Mike Mansfield, right?
And maybe his Senate majority leader was anti-war.
A good historic point to finish.
Who knew had taught Asian history in university and said, this is not necessary. So
beyond that, I don't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, sure.
That China, one of the fears was China was going to
absolutely
end the war, right?
Yeah.
Mansfield had a little insight into that.
Sure. And if could I close with this?
That's what I'm intending.
Yeah. This is a happy story, I promise. Truman, I think, was probably better read in presidential history than almost anyone else. And that's particularly notable because Truman did not have a college education. And this is how that happened. He grew up in Missouri. His bad eyesight, he had these thick glasses. His parents were poor, said no contact sports because we cannot afford to replace your glasses. So he said, as a result, I read every book in the Independence, Missouri Public Library, which I always thought was an exaggeration until I went there. It's a small library, was probably true.
Yeah.
But anyway, when he finished high school, this quite smart young man wanted to go to college. The family said, we're too poor, you have to work the plow instead. He was denied going to college. It just drives you crazy that this young man could not have had a college education. So he becomes president in 1945, wants to do something that is not just fulfilling the last wishes of Franklin Roosevelt, who had died and caused him to become president. So guess what one of Truman's first aims is? He says, I think I'm going to put some resources into the community college system so that no young person in America who wants to go to college as badly as I did is going to be denied that experience. So I don't think much of Harry Truman and his decision-making on Korea, although not of the Woodrow Wilson level.
Right.
But I do admire what he did to try to help young people to go to college, and that affects all of us to this day.
Let's finish on that upper. Thank you. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.
There'll be a book signing outside. I highly recommend it. Thank you, everybody, and thank you, Michael.
Thank you.